Welcome to the small lecture course on topological quantum field theories. Thanks for signing up. Thanks for coming. Let me just start with some small organizational comments. So the first one is that I'm happy about any type of feedback. This is the first longer course I'm giving. So if you're unhappy with something, or if you want to go in a different direction, please let me know. I mean, I'm mostly teaching for you and not for myself. So. Yeah, I'm happy about any type of feedback. I'm not assuming much background. I assume that everyone is familiar with what a manifold is and maybe some basic topology, like an open set, a topological space, but I'm not assuming any familiarity with categories or anything in that direction. So if everyone has a background and the things I'm doing are too basic, please let me know. Also, if there's something I'm assuming you know and you don't know, please let me know as well. So this is, yeah, just to say. There should be recordings online. And then the last thing, I was wondering if people are interested in having exercises. I mean, there will be some exercises throughout, which are mostly things which should be easy to show from the definitions, and I'm too lazy to do in the lecture. So I present them as exercises. But then I could also give you more thorough exercises which help you engage with the material. Just let me know if you want that or not. And then another warning, the course is mostly going to be mathematics. We will start with some physical motivation today, but then we mostly just develop the mathematical framework. And yeah, so there's not much like actual physical applications happening. There might be some at the end, depending on time, okay. So now let me briefly sketch what we will actually do. So today we will start with some motivation, which essentially explains how one can arrive at the definition starting from a past integral perspective. So there's some physics. Then the second part will be definitions of monoidal categories. Which then allows us to state a precise definition of a topological quantum field theory. We will then do some basic properties. So just showing some things which follow from the definition. And also the one-dimensional case, section 4, will be the 2D classification. And then the last thing I've planned so far is that we will do Dieger-Witten series. These are finite gauge series. They are just a nice and simple example, which is based on some physical intuition. And the idea is to be reasonably detailed about these few things, and then the section 6, it's some modern or advanced topics. And then depending on interest, we could either do something like invertible field theories or lattice models, state sum models, Ricci-Tikhonov theories, 2F0 models, four-dimensional versions, things like that, or maybe defects or orbifolds, depending on what people want to know at that point. But this is later. Let me just say a few words on why TQFTs are interesting. I mean, there are a lot of reasons. I think for a while, especially after their definition, it was mostly because it's a version of quantum field theory, which is well defined and you can prove theorems about. So it's a nice toy model to actually study things more rigorously. But recently, there also have been used in many actual physical applications. For example, in the study of anomalies, the modern perspective is that those live on boundaries of higher dimensional invertible field theories, which are essentially or really close to topological series. So the tools people develop to study these TQFTs can be applied in this setting. A different setting where they are now really important is in the description of non-invertible discrete symmetries or higher form symmetries, where this idea that a theory with a specific symmetry sits on the boundary of some higher dimensional topological theory encoding the symmetries. They also sometimes can be used to get informations about quantum systems or phases by looking at the low energy limit of a gap system, which regularly turns out to be topological. And then if there are people interested in mathematics, I mean, one thing is it's a toy model for quantum field theory. And this has, quantum field theory has many important applications in mathematics, but here there are somehow things where we can actually study quantum field theory. And more concretely, it nowadays has connections to what's called stable homotopy theory, mostly through the study of invertible theories, modular tensor categories or fusion categories, which is the mathematical underlying of the three-dimensional models. Then connections to higher categories through things like the cobordism hypothesis or fully extended theories. And finally, there's connections to topology and manifold invariants. Because if I have a quantum field theory, I can compute a partition function on a manifold, which will give me some invariant. And these things have been extremely interesting. Like, I mean, what started the whole subject is somehow Witten's computation that if you compute Wilson lines in the Shon-Simon theory, you recover the Jones polynomial. Yeah. So I hope this is some motivation to learn about what a TQ of T is and how you think about it mathematically. So are there questions or comments on this like general outline of the course? Okay, if not, let me start. So what I want to do is I somehow want to start with motivating the definition. And then after this like brief motivation, we will spend a lot of time actually getting to a point where we can state the definition. But and for this is like the most physical bit of the course probably. So we asked somehow what does it mean for quantum field theory to be topological, and we just we'll do this from a path integral perspective. So generally, a quantum field theory, at least in a more traditional setting, somehow starts out by fixing some spacetime. So this is a manifold M. Let's say it's M is an n-dimensional manifold. And it's equipped with some geometric structure, so plus some geometric structure, which usually at least includes something like a Lorentzian or a Riemannian matrix. So, for example, let's say a matrix, which is a section of the cotangent bundle. And then there might be some additional structure one needs to define the series, like a spin structure if one wants to include fermions or similar things. But then, so there are these like geometric structures we somehow fix, and then there are some fields we consider dynamical usually. And so there's like a space of dynamical fields. Which are elements of some type of object depending on the manifold M and maybe on the geometric structure. So in common examples showing up is something like this being smooth functions on M with values in the reals, or maybe the complex numbers, or maybe some target space if you do a sigma model, or maybe something like G bundles with a connection on M if you do gauge theory, something like Yang-Mills theory or so. And then somehow the whole classical theory is encoded by some type of local action functional. So we assume that there's a map which goes from F of M to the real numbers, which we assume to be local. And I'm not going to explain what I mean exactly or what one usually means by local. I just somehow one assumes that this function can be written, so it depends on the fields. And for this introduction, I just assume that I can write it as an integral over M of some Lagrangian density, which depends on the field at a point, and maybe it's all its derivatives. Also, this is not, yeah, just not so important in general. And then as an example, again, one can use, if one takes F to be the smooth functions on the manifold, and one has a metric, one can take something like a free scalar series. So one takes, like this is some differential operator one can form from the metric, and then one can add like whatever type of corrections one wants and integrate something like this with respect to the volume element for the metric. I should really say all this differential geometry will later on not be important. So this is just to like get to a point where we can state the definition, and then from. So if you do not exactly understand how these things are defined, it's not a big deal. So this encodes the classical dynamics of the theory by finding the extrema of this action functional, and then quantum theory, what one wants to compute, are so-called correlation functions. So one has some observables O1 up to OP, which are something like functions on this space of fields, more or less, and we want to compute the expectation value or the correlation functions, which is something like 1 divided by some normalization factor, and then an integral over all fields, the observables applied to the fields, and then e to the I, and then the action of the field. And the integral formally runs over the space of fields on M. And I mean, one of the problems with mathematically understanding quantum field theory is that like this space of fields is usually highly infinite dimensional, so it's hard to integrate over it or to construct measures on it, which so that this expression makes sense, but essentially this is what one wants to compute, and this normalization function is usually called this normalization factor is usually called the partition function. And it's just given by the integral of the action. Okay.
Sorry. What does your notation mean over there? The second type of function space?
This is G bundles on M with connection. So it's like you fix some Lie group G, and then you take like all principal bundles with connection. Used to have. Okay, and let me highlight here that all these things explicitly depend on the metric G. Right? I mean, this depends on G. This depends also on G. Okay, and now the naive definition is something like, oh, we call a theory topological if when I take all these correlation functions and study how they vary with respect to the metric, then this is zero. Meaning the correlation functions or the partition functions and everything else turns out to be independent of the metric. Okay. So we say, a theory, I should have put some, a theory is topological if this type of equation holds. And probably the most famous example of a theory which is topological is Jean-Simon's theory, which is given by something like we take a trace, so this is something like a multiple of a Killing form. A here is some connection on a principal bundle, and then so this only depends on the connection, but it doesn't depend on the metric. And actually, Schoen-Simons theory turns out to have a really mild metric dependence, which can be traced back to the fact that this thing is actually not as well defined as one would like it to be. I mean, another example where one has a theory which is independent of the metric, or at least supposed to be independent of a metric, is any type of quantum gravity theory, because there you do a path integral over metrics, so there's an independence. And this seems to, in higher dimensions somehow, not to work that well, but 3D quantum gravity really fits into the framework we will discuss. This is another example. Okay. So far, so good. But now, so are there questions? Yep.
So you said the action is local. Is there a reason why you restrict to local action?
I mean, there will be a reason in a moment. There's like a property where it follows from. I think it's physically natural that you don't want to have like interactions at a distance somehow. But it essentially, I think if the action is non-local, there are not many things one can do somehow. Especially, I mean, here, right, for this, nothing needed the action to be local, but in a moment we will study how these things behave under cutting and gluing of manifolds, which is the essential idea behind the whole setting of topological quantum field theories, and there you really need locality to get a decomposition. I didn't say what I mean by local, right? I just said it's something like it looks like this. And I don't really want to say. We will see an implication of that in a moment, which is what we will need. More questions? Okay. So far, so good. Usually, if we consider a quantum field theory, there's another quantity which is important, which is a Hilbert space of states. So here, sigma is some n minus one dimensional time slice or manifold. And it's supposed to be something like square integrable functions on the space of fields on sigma. I mean, same, there are size issues, so this doesn't make that much sense, but we can try to see what type of formal properties these objects have. And one thing is, if I look at the disjoint union of two manifolds, so I just have like my sigma sitting here, and then I have a disconnected copy sigma prime, then formally the Hilbert space is L2 functions on F for this disjoint union. And this is the first place where something like locality enters, at least for the fields. So if I have a field on sigma and one on sigma prime, this is the same as just giving a pair of a field here and a field there. So this is the same as L2 functions on F sigma times F sigma prime. And this turns out to be the tensor product of L2 functions on sigma times sigma prime. So we expect the Hilbert spaces to satisfy a relation like this. If I look at the state space of a disjoint union, this corresponds to the tensor product. So this should also look familiar just from general quantum theory. This is somehow how you couple or how you put systems in contact. And this is one of the things which will later on go into our definition.
Okay.
And now we will get to the point where we actually exploit locality to get more structure or more data. So we start with some space-time M. And the type of question we want to study is,
that product should always be symmetric, or it depends if, like on the theory that you have.
What do you mean with symmetric?
Like, is that always a tensor product, or like if you have fermions?
It should also be a tensor product if there are fermions. But then it's a tensor product of super vector spaces.
Ah, okay.
Right. So there will be, right, if you tensor two fermions, they look bosonic, something like this. So you should encode this by a degree. Yeah.
If you take a scalar field theory, for example.
What?
If you take a scalar field theory,
yes.
For example, this is also something we discussed in the entanglement reading group, that the Hilbert spaces doesn't factorize neatly. Is there something that you're assuming
topological
field theories that lets you do this?
I think in the right, what happened in the quantum entanglement set story was that we had some Rn, right? And then we had some open regions, but they somehow were sitting. So this was some U, and then there was some Rn minus U, right? But they were sitting in the same, on the same, somehow inside the same space-time manifold. Here it's more like I take them and I place them like completely disconnected to each other. I think then this should always work.
So we should think of the sigma-sigma primes living in different manifolds?
They are just different manifolds. Yeah, exactly. And there's no, they are not connected somehow. But here, they share a boundary. And this is where the whole problem came from, that there was somehow like stuff happening at the boundary, which spoils the factorization. More questions?
Also, in that case, it was the operator algebra that factorized, maybe? I don't know if it was the Hilbert space was, but I don't know. Maybe, I'm not even sure about that, but I know
it's me. Okay, so what we want to study is, to this manifold, we associated the partition function, and we want to understand how the partition function behaves under cutting and gluing. And then, so we take our manifold and then we cut it into three bits, which I call M1, M2, four bits, M3 and M4. And they now all become manifolds with boundary. We think of this direction as the time. So we have all these, we have this manifold with boundary, and now we somehow try to evaluate our theory on the pieces and see what we get there, just from a formal path integral setting. So let us first look at the element M1 here. And now the question is, what does our theory assign to this manifold with boundary? And it turns out, or we can, from the path integral, we can actually build a state Z of M1, which sits in the Hilbert space reassigned to sigma 1. So this is sigma 1. I should probably add them here. So sigma 1, sigma 2 is both these things, and then there's a sigma 3 here. Okay, and how does this space vector look? What we need to do is we need to take a field which lives on sigma 1, and I need to give you a number. So I need to define some function on the space of fields, and we will drop square integrability. No. I mean, this is all formal anyway. So, and what we do is we look at the path integral. But now we integrate over fields on M1, which have the property that when I restrict them to the boundary, then I get the fixed thing I want on the boundary. So I'm not integrating over all fields on this manifold with boundary, but only those restricting to a fixed boundary field, and this defines for me a function on the on all the boundaries. So this is this map here. I can think of as an element in this in L2 of F on sigma 1. Okay. And now we look at the next bit in this decomposition we had over there.
Sorry, I'm a bit confused by that annotation. Z is your partial function for M1?
Yes.
Are you saying that it's an element of the Hilbert space?
Yeah, I'm saying if you compute the path integral over M1, you should not think of this as one number, but you should actually think of it as an element in the Hilbert space for sigma 1, because there's this boundary, and so you should more think of it as giving you a number when you fix a boundary condition or boundary field. So it's, you should more think of it as a function on the boundary labels. That's what I'm saying. Okay, and now we have this thing. This is M2. So there's some incoming boundary here, sigma 1. And then there's an outcoming boundary here, sigma 2. And this thing this will be important in a week or so. It's called a cobordism, which is just a manifold which somehow has an incoming and an outgoing boundary. Okay. And now the question is, what does the theory assign to an object like this, where I somehow in addition distinguish in and outgoing boundaries? And the claim is, now that this actually defines a map from the Hilbert space on sigma 1 to the Hilbert space on sigma 2. Okay, and it should be a generalization of the formula up there. So I have some function f which depends on the fields living here. And what I can do is I can map this to a function which takes fields on here as an input. So it takes some field on sigma 2 and maps it again to a path integral. So I map to fields on M2, which restrict to sigma 2 on the boundary. And then I integrate the action for this field, and I apply f to the field restricted to the other boundary. Right, so I can take a field defined on M2. If I restrict it to sigma 1, I get a field defined on here, and that's an input for this function. And this whole thing for me defines a new function. So there's associated to this bordism, there's a linear map between Hilbert spaces. And now, so the thing we did before, if we think of M1 as a map which goes from an empty manifold to sigma 1, then we can also think of this as a map from C to the Hilbert space on sigma 1. So this is somehow a special case of the other thing where the functions on an empty set is just constants. Okay. And so we want to understand somehow how we can recover the value of M from knowing these local pieces. So that's what we want to see next. So thing we want to look at is somehow now what happens if I take M2 and M3. I have linear maps corresponding to both of them, and I compose those maps. So what I want to compute is V of M2 composed with Z of M3. Okay. And as an input, I take some function which I can evaluate on fields on sigma 1. So there's some f. And then as an output, so this composition of linear maps should be a function I can evaluate on fields which live on sigma 3. Okay. And now we just plug in the definition we have up there. So we first see what we get if we apply this. there we get a path integral over a field living on M3, which restrict, when I restrict them to the boundary, if I restrict them to sigma 3, I get phi sigma 3. So this is just the definition I gave up there, now applied to a special case, and then I have some function I integrate, so I put in, oh, there should be no minus up there, and then I put in the function, so the function is now z of M2 evaluated on f. Evaluated on f, evaluated on phi M3 restricted to sigma 2. Okay. So far, I just used the definition I gave up there and plugged this whole thing as a function into it. So I took this box and plugged it into z of M3. And now we will also unpack what z of M2 is. So
I have two questions about this definition. And the first one is, when you write, I guess are you identifying the dual of the Hilbert spaces to the Hilbert space?
No. I mean, right, the dual of a Hilbert space is usually not the Hilbert space. It's like its complex conjugate.
Yeah, but so the argument for the fact that the Fortune function is inside the Hilbert space of sigma 1 is that it's a functional, right? That takes a state from n limit of the Hilbert space of sigma 1 and then outputs a number.
Like you mean this thing? Yeah. You're saying this also is a functional, yes. But you're saying this is a functional on all these boundary things? And then if you think of all these things as boundaries and you do this, you would compute a matrix coefficient for your linear map. That's what you're asking? But you need...
I think it's confusion is partly because it's a functional on the fields. So let's say...
No, I think, so very simply put, sorry for interrupting, is that the notation that z is in the Hilbert space of sigma 1, the partition function is an element of the Hilbert space of sigma 1.
Yeah.
The way I understand it is that it takes in an element of the Hilbert space of sigma 1 and then gives you a number, right? By that definition?
The element in here are L2 functions on f of sigma 1. So I need to give you a function on fields. Right, the state space is something like square integrable functions on the fields.
Oh, I think I'm just missing something. That's okay.
So are there distinguish between which one does go away if I can take a dual?
There's some, we will do this more detailed later on. Right, these manifolds should be oriented, so they have some inverse pointing things. And then if you look at the induced orientations based on some conventions, you will actually see that if I take this manifold and I cut it open here, what happens is, and I look at the induced orientations on sigma, they will actually mismatch. One of them will be sigma with one orientation and the other one with the other orientation. And you use these orientations to distinguish which direction things go. And taking a dual is reversing the orientation, exactly. And we will do that in more detail in a week or so. More questions?
Yeah. There is an additive structure on the Hilbert space. I'm wondering, does it make sense to add two different boundary conditions
That
definition?
I'm adding functions on boundary conditions. I'm not really adding boundary conditions. You might ask, can you add them or something like that? But
okay.
One confusion might be when I talk about fields at the boundary, I really mean classical fields, no quantum fields or something like that. And then you might be able to do a mode expansion to understand the L2 functions, and then these might be the fields you had in mind. And not sure. Okay, more questions. Yeah.
I guess connecting to your last comment. So when you say field, am I just safe to think of a C infinity function or something like
yes.
that?
Yes. Or no.
Are there other interesting examples?
Like flat principal connections on a bundle. Something like that. Maps to some manifold. Like sections of some principal, of some, not principal, of some bundle. Like if you have a spin manifold, you can look at sections of the spin or bin bundle. All these things will never appear again. So
it's, you wouldn't take like a one-man algebras or anything like that as fields. It's just functions somewhere in some manifold.
Yes, they are classical fields.
Okay.
They should somehow naively come from differential geometry. Yeah. More questions? Yeah.
Could you say again what the function f is over here?
Which function?
Yeah, so I'm trying to understand what z and h mean. But,
So this is just an element in the Hilbert space.
Okay.
Which is a function on the classical fields on the boundary. And then I will need to build a new function which takes as an input a field defined on sigma 2. And I do that by somehow fixing, like summing over all, integrating over all fields on M2, which restrict to this fixed one, and then evaluate the original function. I mean, this is something like if you know cohomology, I mean, this is not a helpful answer, but it's something like a pull push construction in cohomology. And we will. So we, when we do Dyckerf-Witten series, there's actually an example where we can make this integral sign precise, and then we will see that this actually provides a, yeah. So the integral sign in this setting will just become a sum over some finite collection of things, and then we can show that all these formulas actually hold, and then not formal expressions we use to come up with a definition.
This minus sign e to the minus I.
There should be no minus. No, I'm just.
Okay. It's not the orientation or something.
I mean, if you reverse the orientation, you would get a minus, yes. But I'm just. I think Euclidean actions usually have a minus, and I'm just confused. Okay. The next part is to unpack what is z of m2 of f here. So we do that, and hope I did this carefully. So it's, again, the same integral we had before. We integrate over things on M3. When restricted to sigma 3, there is some phi 3. And now if I unpack the definition of the z of M2, I get a second integral. So I get an integral over fields which now live on M2. And if I restrict them to sigma 2, they should be equal to the restriction of sigma m3 to sigma 3, because this is the argument I plug into this function. And then I have f applied to phi m2 restricted to sigma 1. E to the I S of M3 of phi M3 plus the action for M2 of phi on M2. So I used here that, okay, these are weird brackets. Here I used that if I multiply exponentials, I can add the arguments. So I get this whole expression. And now what we do is to just stare a bit at it. So the first thing we can note, because the action was some type of integral over m, this actually becomes the same as the action on m3 composed with m2, where I, with this expression, just mean the manifold you get by gluing here. And then of the field, which is something like phi M3 composed with phi M2. So this is the field which now lives on all of M, but somehow its component on M3 is given by phi M3, its component on M2 is given by phi M2, and I can glue them together because the assumptions I have here is that they agree on the boundary. So right, this is the assumption I have. So this allows me to glue these things together, and this requires some locality property on the type of fields I consider. And then I have the function f. And now the other thing we notice is here we integrate over fields on M3 and MM2, which agree at sigma 3. And this thing restricts to phi sigma 3 on the boundary. So this turns, this is the same as integrating just over all fields on M, on the composed thing. Which restrict on sigma 3 to the thing we start with. Okay. And then we have f of this thing on restricted to sigma 1 e to I action of this phi. Okay. And this now formally becomes Z of the composed manifold applied to F evaluated on phi 3. So we see formally that if we believe these, or if we follow these definitions coming from a path integral, then the composition of linear maps actually corresponds to the gluing of manifolds. And I want to,
One question. It might be the point I'm missing, but I guess I'm wondering about the meaning of those integrals. So say in a minimal example where you have two to three dimensional manifold and it's smooth functions.
Yeah.
Should I think of these as integration with respect to some measure in the smooth functions or?
Yeah, you should think.
We're trying to kind of run.
The problem, we are somehow, we are pretending they're integrated with respect to some measure. Usually building such a measure is really hard, meaning we don't know how to do it at dimension 4 or something like. No one knows how to do non-free measures. So, and then you definitely know that there's nothing like a Lebesgue measure because it's infinite dimensional. So building these things is hard, and this is one of the problems with defining quantum field theory. So what we are doing at the moment somehow, we pretend these things exist, then see what follows from it, and then we just say, oh, a topological quantum field theory is the structure which follows from it. But somehow I just specify these linear maps without caring if they come from an integration or not. So this is where we are trying to go, just like somehow formally applying these things as if they would make sense and see where we end up, and then try to interpret the answers.
Thanks.
Yes. This is a typo. Is it a typo here, or am I just not? Yes, it's a typo. Okay. The thing we should take home from this is, if I look at the glue, the linear map associated to the glued manifold, this is the composition of the individual pieces. And now if I want to compute what I assign to this big manifold M, what I can do is I can first go from C to sigma 1 by doing this using Z of M1. Then I can do Z of M2 to H of sigma 2 of M3, H of sigma 3, and then I can do Z of M4, which goes back to C. So the condition here is somehow the Hilbert space on the empty set is C. And then if I compose all these linear maps, I get a linear map from the complex numbers to itself, which is just a number, so I can somehow compute partition functions by doing this cutting and gluing style argument. Okay, and now we somehow, based on this, we can try to guess what a TQFT should be. I mean, somehow the topological part about all these things is that these structures should be independent on a metric on M. Oh, okay. So let's start. Guess for a definition. So an n-dimensional EQ of T is the following data. Okay, so, and I will now also assume that all my space times are compact. This is mostly to make the theory easier later on. So it consists of a Hilbert space H of sigma for all compact oriented manifolds and then in addition a linear map Z of M from H of sigma to H of sigma prime for all cobordisms M going from sigma to sigma prime. So I mean just mean for all manifolds like the thing up there which has some ingoing and some outgoing boundary. And then there are some conditions we want to impose on this. One of them is if I look at the Hilbert space associated to a disjoint union of two manifolds, I want this to be the tensor product. And if I mean what I want this to be, what should better require there to be an isomorphism. I want the Hilbert space on the empty set to be isomorphic to the complex numbers. And then I want this relation that composition corresponds to gluing of manifolds. So if I compose these linear maps, then I want this to be equal to the thing I get by gluing the manifolds. And now a question is somehow, is this a good definition? Do I need more structure? What else do I want? And also, is there a convenient way of stating this type of definition? And that's where we are going. So one thing which I haven't stated, but which you might want to require, is if I take the disjoint union of some manifolds with each other, the linear maps corresponding to them are just given by a tensor product on the Hilbert space vectors, and this is exactly one of the things you want, but there might be more. So somehow a question is like, did I miss something in my derivation? And the answer is clearly yes, but also somehow is there a good way of stating it? And if you answer both questions, this might lead to a good definition. So that's where we try to go. Are there questions up to this part? So somehow the end of my motivation. Yeah.
So if the dimension of the sigma is n minus 2, so what do we get?
I mean here, right?
Yeah.
It's only n minus for all compact oriented. n minus 1. Generally, we might talk a bit about that at the end. There's this thing called an extended theory where you, if you take an n minus 2 manifold S, then you want to assign to this something depending on S, which is a C linear category, usually. You should think of this as something as a category of boundary conditions or so, and then if you go down, so if we go to the point, I somehow want to assign to this some C linear n category. And we will not.
Yes. So let's say, can you give me an example of like why do we assign a C linear category for a minus one dimensional system? Like, can you motivate it by path integral?
You can essentially motivate it by a kind of path integral, right? What do you want? Let's do that for a moment. So now imagine my n minus one dimensional manifold is this thing, right? And so far I only allowed to cut once. And I might want to be able, like then I still get complicated manifolds. I mean, the torus is not too complicated, but in high dimensions you will still get complicated manifolds. So you might get the idea that cutting again would be good. So you need to ask what happens if I cut again. And then you want to somehow have the same type of thing, but you want to assign something to this cut thing, which goes from here to between some other things. So this is now sigma 1, sigma 2. And this is something which, if I compose these two things in an appropriate way, this is S, then I want to get a Hilbert space, right? You want to have some way of decomposing your state space into something local. And what is this? You can just do a similar argument as before. Somehow the state space I have given via L2 functions or so, what it is, if you have now a boundary thing, so if I have a manifold, you can ask, what's the Hilbert space for some manifold with boundary, right? And what turns out is that this in general depends on, again, choosing a boundary condition. So there's not one Hilbert space, but for any phi I choose here, I get a boundary. So what I get is somehow the whole Hilbert space is described by a map of F on S1 to Hilbert spaces. Right. And now this is for one, so this is like somehow H of M if sigma, sorry. And this is if sigma has a boundary, which I call S, then it's really a map from the boundary fields to Hilbert spaces. So what should you assign to the boundary? Just by the arguments we had before, we should assign to the boundary something like maps from S to Hilb. Right? And maybe what do I mean with a map from S to Hilb? I may probably mean something like a Hilbert bundle over the space of fields. So the thing I assign to S should be the thing of all Hilbert bundles over the space. And this is naturally a category. Right? And then you can go on somehow. You can always assign maps from the space of fields to whatever the other thing was before, because you can somehow, what you get for a closed thing, you get when you get have a boundary. Okay. But we will maybe at the end talk about the cobordism hypothesis and extended theories, but before that we will not. More questions? Okay. Then let me state the definition we will spend some time explaining. So somehow this is Atiyah's definition, which takes these ideas we have developed here and makes it more precise. And it's TQFT is, and you should, I'm not expecting you to know the words. This is what I will explain next. But this is somehow where we are going, and it's really supposed to make the rough idea we had there precise. So it's a symmetric monoidal functor Z, which goes from a category of cobordisms to the category of vector spaces. And yeah, we will spend probably all of next week and maybe a bit of today if there's still time, like trying to understand what this word even means. And then at some point later we will define what this object is. Let me just briefly mention what type of structure you expect. So somehow these bordisms we have here, there are some type of things which here are formed by the co-dimension one manifolds, and then there are things relating them which I can compose by gluing. And these type of structures just show up all over the place, where you have some collections of things and some other collections of maps relating them. So it has turned out in mathematics useful to have a language to talk about something like that, and this is what's called category theory. So it's just really about having certain things which have maps between them which can be composed. And this is like a good language to make these type of things precise. Okay, questions? I don't know. Also, should I stop after an hour or after 1.5? Probably it's up to me. But it's also up to you. I don't know how much. Yeah.
Is there a particular reason why you take that definition? You take that particular ELF function on sigmoids?
Where?
The partition function on the code. Yeah.
I mean, I try to figure out what type of properties the partition function has under cutting and gluing. And so this is, right, I just write down this thing. But if I would not include this, then I could not recover the whole partition function from the individual parts. Somehow. This is the thing which turns out to be local. So this is the definition. I mean, I know where I wanted to go, right? So I used the definition which makes this work. But this is also what you want somehow. You want to be able to do some local computations on simple building blocks and then glue them together to get more complicated manifolds.
And may I say, if you do like time evolution in quantum mechanics or the generalization of that in quantum field theory, when you write the path integral, that corresponds to time evolution. So it just brings the state into the whole place.
Yeah. Good point. And also what makes the definition topological is that here the manifolds are oriented, but there's no additional structure. So you might think that the same definition works for arbitrary quantum field theories. And people have worked on that. It goes under the name of a functorial theory. But there somehow we nearly don't know any examples. And there are other technical problems. So we restrict to the simpler setting. More questions? So I might go on for 15 more minutes and then stop. But yeah. So we've been doing a lot of physics, like, I don't know, whatever you want to call this, not mathematics, so let's at least do some mathematics. This is now section one, which is about monoidal categories. Okay, and the main reference for the beginning bit is a book by Riehl, which is called Categories in Context. Which is freely available online. Okay. And as I said, what we are aiming for is making the definition which disappeared. Making this definition precise. And for this, these things turn out to be certain type of categories. What we start with is defining. I should also maybe ask who knows what a category is. Okay. Okay. This seems okay. I hope I still have something interesting to say to those. But also, if half or a bit less than half doesn't, I should probably recall this. Okay. And then, yeah. So let's start with a definition, or a slightly informal definition. It's a category which we call C, consists of, so it consists of the following type of things: a collection of objects, which we denote by x, y, or sometimes small x, y, z, and so on, or maybe c and c prime. So we use all these type of notations. And in addition, it consists of a collection of morphisms, which we denote by f and g, and things like that. And then we introduce some notation. So we write objects of C for the class of objects, I mean, just think set of objects, but there are some set theoretical problems. That's why you should consider a class. So, and we write morphisms of C for the class of morphisms. And now, so we have a collection of objects, a collection of morphisms, and now there's more data we need to specify. So first of all, each morphism, each F, has a specified domain and codomain. Domain, meaning source and target. So we write for this, which are objects. So for every f, I have a source and a target. So I can think of my f as a map from x to y. And we write source of f. So f s of f is x, and source of a target of f is y. Okay, and then in addition, we want to be able to compose these things and also have identities for composition. And I mean, the example later on will be these borders, where the class of objects are given by the codimension 1 manifolds, so the n minus 1 dimensional manifold, and the class of morphisms are given by these cobordisms between them. And then we will need some more structure. Each object has an identity morphism, which we denote by the identity at x. And this has the property that it goes from x to x, and each object x has such an operation. And now there are so this is all the data one needs to specify some. There's one more thing, actually. So a list of objects, a list of morphisms. For every morphism, a source and a target. For every object, an identity morphism. And then in addition, we need to specify a composition. composition for all f, let's say they go from x, f goes from x to y, and g goes from y to z. I need to specify a composition which is f composed with g, which goes from x to z. Okay. And now there are some conditions we want. So the first one is, if I take G and compose it with the identity on the source of G, this is the same as taking G, composing it with the identity at the target of G, which is supposed to be G itself. So these identity morphisms, we want to have, they are identities under composition. And then the other condition is that composition is well defined, it's associative. So if I have H, G, and F, which are composable, then I want that these two compositions agree. F, and I want this for all F from X to Y, G from Y to Z, and H from Z to U. I want this, and this just means if I look at a composition, I don't need to bracket the thing. So I will from now on not involve brackets anymore. Okay. So now let's do some examples. I mean, the Bordisms, as I said, they will be an example which we will treat in more detail later. So the easiest thing is the category of sets. The objects are just sets. So any type of set is an object in there, and morphisms. And the morphisms are just functions. The identity morphism is the identity function, composition is composition of functions, and so on. This is one example. The other example is the category of vector spaces. So there the objects are vector spaces. It's vector spaces over the field K. Or complex numbers. I mean, this is what's most interesting for us. And morphisms are linear maps. And composition is again by composition of linear maps. Okay, then we do one last example. Somehow it's a bit more involved, maybe. So we fix the group. And then from this, I define a category which is called B of G. B of G has one object, which I call star. And the morphisms in B of G are just given by G. So I need to tell you how the composition works. So I have a group element G going from star to star, and another one, because there's only one object, I can only have this, which is also defined as the composition of H with G. And we define this, I mean, this is just a notation for this, and we just define this S group multiplication. And now, what is the identity? It's just the identity E. Okay. Oh, yeah, okay. I can do one more definition. I should also say we now just spent some time developing this formal theory, which will be useful later on, but might not seem that useful right now. But yeah, you should have some trust in me that some of the things I define turn out to be useful when we want to study TQFTs later. Let me give you one more definition. So let C be a category. A morphism F, which goes from X to Y, is called an isomorphism. If there exists F inverse, which goes from Y to X, such that F composed with F inverse is the identity on Y, and F inverse composed with F is the identity on X. And then the next definition is C is called a groupoid if every morphism is an isomorphism. And I mean, if you care about invertible field theories or SPTs in the condensed matter literature, then these type of like groupoids are reasonably important. And let me stop by giving you some exercises related to the definition, where I said these are not, these are things which easily follow from the definition, and I'm just too lazy to do, or I feel like there's not enough time to do them, so you want to see if you want to see that they make, if you want to get your hands on this definition, it's nice to check. So first one is that F inverse is unique if it exists, then let F and G be composable, the isomorphisms. This implies F composed with G is an iso. Now the next exercises might be a bit more interesting. The first part is define the term subcategory. And then show, so this is the first bit, and show every C has a subcategory consisting of all its isomorphisms. This thing of all its isomorphisms. And this, I mean, this easily follows, I mean, follows from this and coming up with a good definition. And this thing is called the maximal subgroupoid. And denoted by C cross. Okay. Let me stop here and thanks for listening. Thanks for coming. Are there questions?
What about if a grant operates something less trivial than maybe not trivial, but something other than partition function.
You mean if there are like operator insertions, something like that, or right? I mean, these things usually you encode them by, let's do point operators. So you have some point operators O, and then for every point operator, you would get such a linear map and its position, which you, Right, and then you can get this by just inserting a point operator in this formula. So you get for any manifold with a point which is labeled with some operator, you will still get linear maps, and then the composition behavior still holds. You will also later see, or maybe not, I'm not sure if I will explain this, but in TQFTs, you have a really strong version of the operator state correspondent. Right? Because if I have something like a point, I can just cut out a disk around it, compute the path integral on this thing, which gives me something in the Hilbert space associated to some field sphere, like an n minus one sphere. And so if you know the Hilbert spaces, you know all the operators, all the point operators. And this actually also works for extended operators. More questions?
So operators are just like a fancy point.
What?
It's like a fancy point.
What's a fancy point?
An operator. I mean, I can have different operators, right?
Yes. But whatever your operator is, right, there's a corresponding label in the sphere, which completely describes what this operator does.
Maybe the difference would be how operators interact. Maybe that's one way in which you could extend operators interact in different ways as point operators.
Oh.
Yeah,
I guess. I know what I'm saying.
So operators, well, again, it's...
I mean, a point operator is something like you take the space of fields and you map it to the complex numbers. I mean, this is just something you can measure. And a point operator is something which only depends on the germ of the fields at a point.
I'm trying to understand how to encode in this data.
In what data?
I mean, like, DE is a function.
Yeah. What you should do is to encode it. It's gone. Like how can? What you should do is you should define a new Bordism category, which, where in addition the manifolds come with points which are labeled by what you call operators, and then you still have a functor to vector. Which also allows you to evaluate the points. But somehow, if you have something which doesn't include the point operators, somehow you can reconstruct them from knowing the state space. Mm-hmm. And I mean, one of the more advanced topics at the end would be like extended operators and how to include them in the story.
And because it feels like this.
Yeah, exactly. Right. If you know the state space in a TFT, you know all its local operators. More questions?